Warm up those brains, everybody. It's time once again for the Get More Smarter podcast. This is episode 33. I'm Jason Bain.
I'm Alan Franklin.
And he's here in the room.
In the room, back from D.C., survived, no coronavirus, knock on wood.
I don't know if that's wood, but this week on the Get More Smarter podcast, Colorado had a caucus and nobody came. The coronavirus shakes up politics. We try to figure out what in the hell is wrong with Ken Buck. House Majority Leader Alec Garnett joins us once again to talk about the Colorado legislature.
At the halfway mark, that's going to be a great...
Yeah. So, you know, this is like the eating your vegetables part before you get to the dessert that's
right
Alec.
Nah. So we're the vegetables or are we the... No, he's the dessert.
He's the dessert.
So we're the unpleasant part they have to labor through.
Right, but we're...
To
but
get to the
nutritious,
good stuff.
But we're nutritious.
Nutritious labor. Okay. No, I'm good.
Right.
Let's do it.
Yeah. Something like that.
Yeah.
So Colorado had its caucus on Saturday, and I didn't go because I don't like going to those anymore. And but Ethan went to his first ever caucus.
And we want to hear Ethan describe his first caucus experience.
Was it magical?
It was super lame. To be honest, it was very underwhelming.
Yeah.
I did not live up to expectations.
Yeah.
I showed up at an elementary school. And I guess in each little classroom, there was, you know, a different precinct. In the classroom we were in, it was probably like a first grade or kindergarten. It was full of the teeny tiny chairs for little kids. There's a guinea pig in there, though. That was pretty cool.
What, a live guinea pig?
Yeah, it was the class pet. There was a guinea pig.
Solid.
Yeah. So that was probably the best part of the caucus was the guinea pig.
and watching older people get into those tiny chairs, that's pretty good, too.
Yes. So people... You know, we're in the chairs.
I don't even fit in those anymore, by the way. But don't even try.
Yeah.
They'll need the jaws of life.
I was elected as a delegate to the county convention by default because there are only six eligible people in the room who could do that. So congrats to me, I guess.
No, this is your pathway to glory.
Yeah.
It begins here.
Are you going to the county convention?
Yeah, maybe.
It's a lot like the caucus, only just the same.
Yeah. Who's that? And... people putting forth well-intentioned amendments to add to the party platform, and
that stuff can get really colorful too, depending on your local precinct. I mean, some people are really into some interesting stuff.
It can also go on forever.
They want to know what's up with the aliens. They want to know what's up with the chemtrails. I mean, there's some stuff. Okay,
yeah, it's all very good things.
By God, and the party platform is where we will get to the bottom of it.
That's always the part of the caucus that kills me is when people want to put things in the party platform. Like, I don't even know where that is. Where do you find the party?
No, it's there. You can Google for it.
I'm sure it's on the internet somewhere.
Yeah.
I mean,
you know, nobody actually reads it. I don't know. I don't want to say that's like universally true. They're like high school students doing book reports.
Maybe.
Okay.
Yeah.
And they're like looking up the party platform.
So Have you ever met an elected official who was like, oh, yeah, I was looking at the party platform the other day?
Well, I mean, if you look at the Republican Party platform at the national level, it gets kind of crazy. I mean, they actually have some pretty far-right stuff in there. And I think in some cases, Republican legislators and candidates might be a little reticent to get behind it if they actually knew what it consisted of.
Yeah, well.
Yeah.
So there was some business conducted at the caucus. Democrats had about 15,000 or so total caucus participants. That's way down from previous years. Republicans had considerably less than even that.
Yeah.
You go back to, say, 2008, when Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton were both battling to get on the ballot, 66,000 people turned out to caucus.
Wow. I mean, think about the difference there. I mean, yeah. Obviously, we had a presidential primary. We had a presidential primary in large part because the 2016 presidential caucuses were a disaster.
Right.
They proved themselves to be this, like, undemocratic, backwards-ass way of participating that turned off more voters than it attracted to the process. So going to a regular presidential primary, which, by the way, worked out really well.
Yep.
We had really great turnout.
670,000 Democrats voted
absolutely
on Super Tuesday. Last
super
year.
Successful. Hence the name. But no, the following Saturday, there were these things called caucuses. You had to go to some funky website to look up your precinct number and then take that precinct number and go enter it into a lookup tool on the Colorado Democratic Party's website, and then you would find your caucus location. I mean, that's not an impossible process. Somebody definitely has to be trying to get there, though, and I can't believe
it. It does show the difference, though, when you don't have the presidential candidates on there. You go back to 2016, Colorado had almost 100,000 Democrats show up in caucuses.
Yeah.
15,000 last weekend. The big race was for U.S. Senate to get on the ballot. Andrew Romanoff got 55% of the vote compared to 30% for former Governor John Hickenlooper.
Right.
Romanoff declared this a huge victory.
Basically, the caucuses were underpublicized and underrepresentative of the actual electorate, and it consisted largely of people who were turning out, I mean, to Andrew Romanoff's credit, to support him and to make sure that he made the ballot. Now, despite all of this supposed anti-Hickenlooper sentiment, only winning by 55%, which is roughly the same percentage that Romanoff won 10 years ago at the caucuses over now Senator Michael Bennet, doesn't actually seem like that strong of a result, frankly. And given the fact that all of Hickenlooper's strength is going to come in overwhelming ads leading up to the June 30th primary, it's just caucuses, as we already know from history, are very bad at picking the nominee. And that, combined with the fact that they really do seem to be more trouble than they're worth, it seems like we're moving towards a different system here at some point.
Yeah, for picking that's our candidates. An important point you made earlier about them not reflecting primary and general election winners. In the past 50 years, there have only been three statewide candidates who have won the caucus assembly and gone on to win the general election.
That's right.
It doesn't happen.
That's right. Which means that it's more predictive of somebody not being the nominee than it is for them actually being the nominee. And obviously, that's not a useful part of the process at that point.
So I mentioned earlier, 670,000 Democrats voted on Super Tuesday. 15,000 or so went to the caucuses. It's about 2% of that.
Yep.
Romanoff, with 55% of the vote, then got somewhere around 8,300 supporters at the caucuses.
That's right. Nobody wants to run down the Romanoff campaign. It's clear that they counted very strongly on a good performance at the precinct caucuses. I imagine that they will get top line on the ballot after the state assembly. But again, that doesn't predict the winner. And if you're trying to actually win the election, as opposed to check these boxes that have historically been the boxes you check on the way to defeat, well, Romanoff is kind of in the same vector, if you will, as he was when he lost in 2010 under very similar circumstances to Michael Bennet.
I would imagine it was more of a relief than anything, because this is the only way he was going to get on the ballot.
Well, that's right.
He wasn't collecting petition signatures, so if he did not crack 30% at the caucuses, he wouldn't even be on the June ballot.
That's right. And now, I mean, on March 17th, is the deadline for the submission of signatures for those who are seeking the petition path to the ballot. And that's going to take care of another couple of candidates who were nominally participating in the caucus process. Is it Stephanie Rose Spalding who is both who both tried to get on via the caucuses as well as petitioning? Or was it Trish Zornio? Or was it Lorena Garcia?
Lorena Garcia is only going petition route.
So Lorena Garcia is only going the petition route. I mean, I will tell you that in lines at recent events, presidential rallies and so forth, her signature gatherers have been well represented out there working the lines, trying to get the requisite signatures. If anybody's going to get on the ballot besides Hickenlooper and Romanoff, it's likely to be Lorena Garcia. So,
and Trish Zornio maybe could pick up enough votes in the assemblies at the state assembly to get her name on the ballot, maybe.
Right. So the field's going to thin out to what will ultimately appear here on the primary ballot very soon.
Yeah, and there's no reason to think after the Saturday caucuses or after any of these county and state assemblies that this race will look any different.
No. In 2010, the then August primary ended with 55-45 Michael Bennet win. I think Hickenlooper probably beats that at this point by a few points. Probably comes out 12-14 points ahead in our June 30th primary. There you go. You heard it here. And obviously, in the event I'm wrong, I'll be back to take my lumps. That's what we do.
That's right. But we're never wrong.
Well, we are seldom wrong. Rush Limbaugh says that he's right, like 99.4 or something, whatever. It changes all the time, so it sounds good.
Really? He has that close of a percentage?
It's bullshit.
Huh. How about that?
All right, it's that time of the week that you fast forward the podcast to get to House Majority Leader Alec Garnett giving us all the inside information from the Capitol. This week, I'm doing it from out of the office. We're all in separate locations. We're coronavirus prepared. So let's see if this works.
Happy to be on. Thank you, guys. I am really enjoying these. I'm hearing from a lot of people who are enjoying these conversations. So I think anything we can do to kind of break down the walls and, you know, increase the lines of communication about what's happening is good. And I think this is working. So I'm honored to be on again.
All right. Well, let's start with coronavirus. Do you have any better sense for what might tip the scales toward a decision about shutting down the legislature?
Yeah, so I think we talked about last week how my grocery cart, which, can I just say for the record, it actually wasn't my grocery cart. It was actually Emily's grocery cart. And she listened to the podcast and was like, I can't believe you just like took credit for my hour and a half shopping when you actually were just watching the kids. So for the record, Emily, I'm sorry, it was your shopping cart. And I'm not exactly sure why I said that last week. But I've been like, I think probably one of the most concerned people about this spread of COVID-19 and or coronavirus. So I've been watching it closely. I have been following all the international news closely. I've been watching what other states have been doing. I've been working with the governor's office. And I think where we're at now is we have a hot spot up in Picking County around Aspen. The governor declared a state of emergency yesterday. And because it's a state of emergency around a pandemic, it actually changes the rules that govern, the joint rules that govern the two chambers. And there is this joint rule 44 that has never been used before, that was created in 2009 to address this specific issue, which is a state of emergency, not for like a bomb cyclone snowstorm, but for a pandemic. And because of that, there are different rules that will apply to the legislature. One of them is around this question of if you go into recess, does that stop the 120-day clock? And if so, how does it stop it? So the Constitution, I think, is silent to the fact that the legislature has to meet in 120-day continuous calendar. It says 120 days, but it doesn't say continuous.
It's that consecutive part, right?
Yeah, but it's the consecutive part. Our rules, and like Joint Rule 23 that goes back to 1983, is the one that says consecutive. Joint Rule 44 that is put into place when there's a state of emergency because of a pandemic suspends that rule around continuous. And so there is this idea that you could go into recess and then once the pandemic and the risk had cleared, come back and start. Everything is sort of suspended in air where it may be bills, the days, and then you would come back and just pick up where you left off. I think we just got to make sure that that is the right legal interpretation. But if that's the case, then it comes down to when do you break for recess? And I think health of the public and health of our members and staff is at utmost priority. And we have to figure out when we want to thread that needle. And I think it's all about continuing to do the people's work while at the same time taking a break before the risk is too high. And I think there's sort of two things that could trigger us going into a recess. One could be somebody is deemed to have been tested positive for the coronavirus and has been in the building, testifying on a bill, a staff member has been in the Capitol, and we can verify that. So that's the first thing. And I think that would move us towards recess pretty quickly. The second thing would be if the health experts on the medical emergency team who are working underneath the governor, the chief medical officer, people at CDPHE would call and say, listen, there's a hot spot here and like the risk is pretty high that somebody is going to come into the building with it. Therefore, you should suspend And so that's what we are in constant communication with the governor's team about. We've been meeting with the executive committee, which is members of both parties in leadership. And so I feel like communication lines are pretty open. I think we're trying to figure out, you know, there's like three bills that we would have to pass no matter what. You have to pass a budget. Constitutionally, we have to balance a budget. We have to pass the School Finance Act, which determines how much money we put into the formula that's distributed to all 178 school districts. And then there's a rule review bill that would have to pass, which actually passed the House today. So it's heading over to the Senate. And then there is, I guess there's four bills, the legislative branch budget, which we keep separate from the full budget as a way to prevent the first floor and the governor from holding the budget hostage to negotiate with us when it has like our pay and our staff's pay in it. This has been a separation of powers thing that we've had for a long time. And we just sent the legislative branch budget to the Senate this week as well. So we have moved some of the critical legislation already. And then obviously the budget is forthcoming with a economic forecast next Tuesday. So we're kind of looking at where we are with all of these bills that we must pass and trying to figure out when exactly we would take a break.
If nothing else, couldn't Governor Polis later on just declare a special session too to finish this?
Yeah, for sure. And I think that's, I mean, I think the only challenge there, I love Governor Polis, but the governor sets the agenda for the special session. And so in a way, we're kind of like yielding a little bit of authority to the executive branch there. But listen, we're all working together in what is, you know, the WHO is deemed a worldwide global pandemic. So, you know, we're taking this all very seriously. And I think we're trying to make the best decisions we can with the information that we have.
The silver lining of some of this coronavirus stuff, maybe, I was thinking about on the family leave issue. Do you think coronavirus helps push that issue forward a little more than it might have?
Man, wouldn't it have been awesome had we passed family medical leave like 3 or 4 years ago?
Yeah.
And we would like just be in a situation where everyone was covered. So, yeah, I think it does. I think that it helps. I mean, I think the governor has been trying to lead on that issue, which makes sense in terms of, you know, it's one thing that I brought up with the governor in one of our first briefings was hourly employees who depend on going to work to pay for their rent and their mortgage and their to put food on the table. They're not going to stay home if they have coronavirus because, you know, the priorities they can't. And so trying to make sure we're putting them first in these discussions about emergency operations is critical. Paid family medical leave would solve all of this. So it does help that narrative, though, once that bill's introduced, which I think would, you know, I don't know exactly when that's going to be, maybe next week. But the point is, it's going to help that narrative, though I hope we don't need a pandemic in order to do what's right.
That's the truth. Well, do you think it plays any role in the Colorado option discussion?
I think so. I mean, Craig Hughes was online tweeting today about, it looked like the Colorado Hospital Association was using the stress on hospitals as a reason not to pass public option.
All right. Okay.
Yeah, which doesn't make a ton of sense because the bill doesn't, if the bill were signed into law today, it doesn't go into effect for like 2 years.
Right.
So do I think that it's going to be used either in committee today? It's in committee as we speak, either in committee during testimony or on the floor. Yeah, I think probably it will. Do I think it should? No, I don't think it has anything to do with it. But I do think, you know, I've been on the phone with presidents of hospital systems today because what we want to make sure that we're doing is we're being very responsive to real world pressures that they're feeling because of increased capacity on hospitals. And sure. So trying to look at ways to be more flexible with sharing staff between hospital systems, figuring out ways to prioritize the testing of healthcare professionals who may have been exposed, because there's rules about when, if you've been exposed, you have to get a test back or you're like, you can't come to work. So making sure we prioritize those things are things that I think are very real. We're trying to make sure we have open lines of communication so that if there are things that we need to do legislatively, that we can start working on those now before we go into recess.
What are your early impressions on what you've seen as far as the Hospital Association and others in their opposition strategy to the Colorado option?
They spend a lot of money on TV and on mail. We've talked about that.
I mean to say more like since the bill has been getting ready to be introduced, yeah. And has that shifted their strategy?
Yeah, it has. All of a sudden, it's like, we agree there is a problem in our healthcare industry. We agree prices are too high. We agree that we need to find a solution. It can't just be on the backs of hospitals. And the discussions that have been happening around tables for the last 3 or 4 years have included everybody from the industry, the pharmaceutical side, the doctor side, the hospital side, the insurance side, and everybody points a finger at everybody else. And my frustration is, if it's not public option, we have been saying, I have been saying for months, since the report came out in the fall, I've been saying, if it's not public option, I just want to make sure that we are reducing healthcare costs for the constituents in my district and in everyone else's districts. I can't believe in this late hour, like now is when you're coming to say, whoa, this isn't the solution. We need to find another one. And so in a way, I have just seen this conversation. It is hard at this point to say, let's put that bill on pause and let's open up another conversation. I'm not saying it's impossible. I'm not saying that, you know, they're not trying to do that.
But it's a little disingenuous.
This process is all about timing. I have a lot of respect for Representative Kennedy and Representative Roberts, who have put in hours of work on the legislation that's in committee now. And in a way, it's like, it's hard to put them in a situation now where it's like, wait a minute, just set out all those hours off to the side and let's go back to the drawing table. But, you know, it has happened before, but that's sort of where the strategy is now.
Let me ask you about a couple of gun bills that have gotten some attention. Both of them are somewhat similar. One of them would secure storage for firearms. One would deal with reporting loss or theft of firearm within 24 hours. Surveys show that these have pretty strong public support. Any reason to think these aren't going to make it through?
No, I mean, I always tip my hat to Representative Sullivan. He's one of my best friends in the legislature. I tip my hat to, you know, Kyle Mulca and Monica Duran and Sonia Hawkins Lewis for all of their work in the interim, stakeholding with law enforcement and with a lot of other groups to move forward on this legislation last week. I think it was introduced on Friday. These are really, really common sense bills that are all about responsible gun ownership. I think we can all agree we want to reduce gun violence. We want to reduce gun deaths across Colorado. We have a suicide epidemic in Colorado, especially with our teen population. And when it comes to safe storage, that's a really important piece of it. And making sure that there's mechanisms for people to lock up their guns, making sure that we're educating the public on why safe storage is important. There have been very successful education campaigns in this state, whether or not it was around methamphetamines around 2010 and 11, or whether it was around, you know, how to consume edible marijuana ever since Maureen Dowd put that op-ed in the New York Times where she came to Denver and didn't consume marijuana. Edibles, right? We have done a great job of educating the public on why to do things. And that is the number one thing that can change behavior. And that's what the safe storage bill is prioritizing. And on the lost and stolen piece, there are a lot of firearms that are stolen from cars at, you know, RTD bus stops that are, you know, in long-term parking, can be stolen from homes. And just making sure that law enforcement's aware that those firearms have been stolen is a way to help get illegal guns off the streets. It's a way to protect our communities. We're not taught. I mean, these don't carry the same weight as red flag in particular, or other things that we've done in the past, but they are common sense, and the public wants us to continue to do these things. And so I'm confident that the sponsors are going to get these across the finish line. And it shows a level of legislating for them to identify some things that other states, red states, have done across the country that we should be doing here.
I mean, what is the argument against them? I've seen Republicans kind of dance around some things, but
I think one of the arguments was if your gun is safely stored in another room, or even if there's an exception to a firearm being next to you while you're sleeping. I think one of the arguments I've seen pop up is like, you're criminalizing going to the bathroom and not being in the same room with, for the most part, these bills have been presented in a way that are very common sense, that blue, red, and purple states have moved on across the country, and that the public thinks we should be doing here. And it's, you know, I'm not exactly sure what's, you know, the level of opposition that is going to come. I never really understand where RMGO, what angles they come from. But I think for the most part, the people of Colorado think this is very common sense.
What else should we be watching for? What else are you watching for this week and next week?
You know, one of the big issues that's starting to stress me out a lot, actually, is the two-party process for getting candidates onto the ballot. There are two paths for state house, state senate, and statewide and congressional electeds and candidates to get onto the primary ballot in June. One of them is by collecting petition signatures, and the other one is going through the caucus and assembly process. There is obviously a higher risk of public spread, community spread of COVID-19 in rooms with a lot of people. And there is going to be a very fast-paced assembly calendar coming up that is going to have a lot of people who are the most highly at-risk population in the same room together. And so we are working in a bipartisan way with our Democratic attorney and with the Republican attorney and with the county clerks to figure out a way to possibly, in sort of an emergency setting, allowing the parties to redraft rules in even years. There's actually a statute that says you can't amend the rules of the parties until an odd year, so 2021.
Right, which makes sense when there's not an emergency, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And so what we're trying to do is just think through if there's anything we need to do legislatively to make sure that our election season, primary season that we're in the middle of, goes off without putting people at risk.
Well, that's one heck of a schedule you got there. You got a lot on your plate. I can't let you go, though, without asking you about dogs on patios, man.
Oh, man, dude.
Dogs on patios. I didn't realize you couldn't have dogs on patios. I thought it was like a requirement in Colorado. Everywhere I go,
I know
people have dogs on patios. So wait, what's the deal with this bill?
I tip my hat to Senator Donovan. I'm just her House sponsor. Senate Bill 78, it's gotten a lot of attention from the media and from others. What it essentially says is if the business owner, so we're going to start at the smallest unit and go out, if the business owner agrees and the municipality agrees to allow dogs on patios, then what the state is saying is that is allowed. Essentially what happened is there have been some examples of county attorneys across the state saying even if the local government agrees and even if the business owner agrees, we don't think that you're allowed to have dogs on patios. And so in that rare instance, because we're the state and we would, you know, oversee the 64 counties, we would say, just to clarify, if all of these factors are met, dogs can be on patios. And that just, you know, we're not taking away any local control in the sense of forcing it on business owners or, you know, forcing it upon municipalities. We're just saying that in that very rare instance that the county attorney is unclear, we're going to make sure that we are crystal clear on the state level. But it has turned into a bill that has gotten a lot of attention. We ran an amendment. So we ran it on second reading. We had it up on third reading. Then a member came up and said, I want to run an amendment to add all of the names of like every legislator's dog to the legislative declaration. So instead of me amending it on third, listen, dude, we all think we're pretty important and we want our dogs to be memorialized in state statute forever. So Cleopatra, my little bulldog, her name was on the amendment, but we didn't want to do it on third reading because we didn't want to like violate House rules. So I sent it back to second reading. So we draft this amendment. We had all of the legislators' dogs' names on it. Then staff from the Colorado Channel calls Katie in my office and says, we want to add all our dogs' names
to
it.
Oh, my God.
So then we add all their dogs' names to it. So then our staff, our partisan staff, are like, we want our dogs' name to it. So actually, while we're running the bill on second reading this morning, we move the amendment with all these dogs included. And all these other staff come down and other members saying, my dog's not included. So then Representative Humphrey, who is a Republican and I am friends with, he's my friend, but we almost never agree on policy, gets a substitute amendment drafted with all of the new dogs' names added to it and runs that. And it got passed, and it is going to be something that, you know, maybe is my legacy.
Well, but the problem, not really a problem I have, but what if I have like a pet kangaroo? Does that work too?
Good point. It came up in debate. Yeah, it came up. What else came up on debate was kitties on leashes, potbelly pigs, birds, you know, all these other things. There are two things that govern how we legislate down here at the Capitol. One is single subject, and two is the title of the bill. So if the title of the bill would have said pets on patios, it would have included snakes, boa constrictors, rats, chinchillas. But because it said dogs, I couldn't amend in these other pets because the title said dogs. And by doing that, you can't amend the title, but you can't expand the title. So you can't go from dogs to pets. You could go from pets to dogs, cats, and chinchillas. But because it started out as dogs, it was just dogs, and it broke the heart of many.
So my kangaroo has to wait for next year.
Yeah, your kangaroo can either run a bill for just kangaroos on patios, or we can run a bill for pets on patios, which would include a definition of pet, which you'd have to make sure kangaroo was there.
Of course, and the smartass in me is thinking, well, what if I name my kangaroo Dogs? Just the proper name of my pet.
I don't know. I don't think changing the name of your pet to the species of animal included in the title would allow you to qualify.
Well, but we'll see what the courts have to say about that one.
Yeah, that's right. You can, and you know what? I there's a petition clause. So if you're so offended that your kangaroo named Dog isn't included, you can go collect enough petitions to go and get it removed through the initiative process on the ballot.
You got to have a sense of humor to do this job. You really do. I don't know how you'd get through it otherwise. Anything else we need to be looking out for?
No, I think we covered it. We'll keep our eye out on COVID-19, and rest assured we're watching it closely, and we're doing everything we can to keep everyone safe, and we will touch base next week.
Great. Thanks very much.
All right. See you guys.
And that's House Majority Leader Alec Garnett. Joins us just about every week during the legislative session as part of Get More Smarter's podcast and the Smart Alec podcast. A lot of smart things in there.
As we're recording this, it's what I'll call Better Than Average Tuesday.
Better Than Average Tuesday.
Not exactly
Super Tuesday
super.
Part due.
But it's not as super as last week.
It's not. It feels a lot less super.
It does.
It's just a few kind of ordinary states, really. God, that's going to sound terrible to the people who live in those states. Nothing personal, guys.
Six states. Let me see if I can name it. Mississippi, Missouri, Michigan, Washington, Idaho. North Dakota.
Ah, all right. Very nice. So three M's, an N, and an I, and a what?
W.
Okay. So, yeah, we are recording on Tuesday. The polls have not closed yet in these states, so we'll be interested in seeing what the result is. Some of the later information that I've seen showed Joe Biden well ahead in Michigan in what could turn out to be a decisive race.
If he wins Michigan handily, Bernie's going to have a hard time.
That's right. I mean, overall, the turnabout in the Democratic presidential race, the shift in momentum from Bernie Sanders to Joe Biden is a pretty remarkable thing. You know, depending on your personal political preference and stands on various issues, you may not regard this to be an entirely positive development. A lot of people are in the position of, you know, holding their nose and waiting for the outcome here, recognizing that their first choice is out of the race. And it seems like that's been a little bit harder to make the adjustment. Or maybe that's just me as a disgruntled Warren
supporter.
National
polls show that this race is very much opened up for Biden. A CNN poll of Democratic voters had Biden up 52-36. Quinnipiac University had Biden up 54-35.
Yeah.
Not the same numbers. It's funny because three weeks ago, it seemed almost certain that Bernie Sanders would be the nominee. Now, I wouldn't put money on it.
I honestly feel like there was a message very successfully sent to the greater part of the Democratic primary electorate who is not ideologically polarized or willing to claim a hard and fast ideology, that having a pitched ideological battle between an ardent leftist, avowed Democratic socialist, and a unhinged far-right demagogue was going to be less than desirable odds relative to a familiar figure that the country knows.
We talked
knows.
About this last week after the exit polls on Super Tuesday showed that people, their primary motivation was someone who could beat Trump much more consistently and in higher numbers than finding a candidate who they agree with on all the issues. And it just...
Now, for the left, that's not really a victory. I have to tell you that what this means is that a lot of the very ambitious goals that were not just held by Bernie Sanders, but by other progressive candidates and a large segment of the Democratic electorate, well, we're not going in that direction now.
Though it does depend on who Biden, if Biden is the nominee, who he decides to choose as his vice president.
Because it's true.
Given Biden's age, it's very possible that his vice presidential nominee will be in the White House at some point soon.
Well, conversely, if Sanders should still prevail, then he's going to seek a moderating influence. I think that this message that there's a need to hew to the center came very late in this primary and rather disruptively. I'm not sure actually how Bernie Sanders supporters are dealing with this right now, because it's an unexpected development that runs counter to a lot of the core messaging that we've heard from Bernie, which is a very insurgent, you know, non-establishment type of campaign. So I don't know. What do you think, Ethan?
I just sort of the resident Bernie supporter, it is very frustrating to see the entire rest of the party coalesce around Biden.
Yeah.
And I think, like I said, people's number one issue is beating Trump, and the Sanders campaign has spent a lot of time. I don't think they spent enough time explaining how he is the best choice to beat Trump. And I agree with that. I think if you look at since 2000 and even before, every time a major party has run a, quote, safe candidate, they've lost. If you look in 2000 with Al Gore, he lost. 2004, John Kerry, the safe candidate, he lost. John McCain, the sort of moderate safe candidate, lost. 2012, Mitt Romney, the so-called safe candidate, lost. 2016, Hillary Clinton, the so-called safe candidate, lost. So when parties have tacked to the center and tried to pick a more moderate candidate who has not promised as much change, has not brought out excitement from people, they've lost. And that's what the record shows.
Not entirely, though. Like, I mean, when you're talking about McCain, I mean, that was against Obama. And you know, you're talking about the first African-American to ever be elected to the presidency.
Yeah,
that was a little
exactly.
Harder to guess. You couldn't really say that was the safer choice.
No, but Barack Obama was not the safe choice. That's the thing. He was, people never thought, oh, we can never get a black man in the White House. Granted, I was much younger. I didn't vote in the 2008 election.
Yeah.
So I'm just remembering this in retrospect.
Well, I recall in 2008, of course, the Democrats had quickly gotten down to the choice of Hillary Clinton versus Barack Obama, which was either way a history-making precedent. And Obama prevailed. Obama won election in 2008 by a fairly narrow margin. Come back in 2016, and the question was, well, is there deeper prejudice in the American electorate for a woman or for an African American? And then we found out that the American people were willing to elect Trump over a woman.
True. I mean,
that's it's just a dark moment in our history.
Yeah, and obviously there are a million more factors in the 2016 election than just the question of whether or not people were more bigoted against a black man or a woman. There are a ton more factors in that. But, you know, I think what Trump did and what I think a lot of people like Trump is that he excited a lot of people. He was something different.
He was
I think that's the same thing as Bernie Sanders. And not to mention the fact that it would be historic as the first Jewish president. That's, you know, that's not something to be undersold. And as a member of the tribe myself, I think that would be cool.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, the thing I will look back on, I think, about and remember most about the 2020 Democratic presidential primary is how quickly it just became two candidates. I mean, it really seemed like, well, it was a matter of days that it went from, you know, six or seven in the field to Bernie and Biden.
I think the specter of a contested convention got to a lot of voters. They were like, wait a minute, this could really be chaos that could be bad for Democrats at a time that they
need least. Was it voters or
was
it the sight of a contested convention of people sort of at the top of the party? Well, there's
not enough. There's not enough.
There's not enough people at the top of the party to account for the millions of votes. I mean, either they were able to, you know, influence and persuade millions of voters, or those millions of voters were able to use their own agency to look at the facts and determine what they thought would be the best course for defeating Trump.
True, but remember, on Super Tuesday, there were significantly fewer options. It was after South Carolina, and you know, the first few states, Biden had done very poorly. And it was after South Carolina where, you know, someone like Pete Buttigieg had really done pretty decently. The rest of the middle candidates, Amy Klobuchar and Pete Buttigieg, dropped out.
Yeah.
So, you know, had they stayed in longer and really tried to go after it, there could be significant results. And by the two of them dropping out, I think there was a report from the New York Times that Barack Obama kind of called Pete Buttigieg after South Carolina and didn't tell him necessarily to drop out. Or who to support.
But anyone who was being honest with Buttigieg after South Carolina would have said, dude, I don't think this is going to work.
Well, not just that. I mean, Bernie Sanders consolidated the ideological left. He is definitely the candidate of the ideological left. He took the support from Elizabeth Warren to kind of solidify that position. On the other side of this, you had several different candidates who were appealing to the center or to the center-left Democratic coalition that is still a big part of the electorate and pretty decisive, as it turns out. And as long as all of those different candidates were in the race, dividing what was in effect the non-Sanders vote, they were paving the way for Sanders to be nominated based on 30-35% of the vote in most of these states. Now that these candidates are out, Biden is coming from behind, but he's very quickly erased the advantage that Sanders has. And
that showed Sanders has a ceiling.
He has a ceiling, but most importantly, his strength was in large part the result of divided opposition.
Yeah.
And in raw percentages, he was actually underperforming relative to 2016. So
I would be interested to read sort of months from now or a year from now when they go back and look at these campaigns a little more closely, or you know, people write their books about them, what it was that prevented Bernie Sanders from growing his base of support substantially.
I'm not sure. Right. And I mean, there's going to be a judgment as to whether or not this sudden recoil from ideological stridency was warranted.
I think as a Bernie Sanders supporter, I might reframe the question as, what did the rest of the Democratic Party do to stunt Bernie's growth?
Yeah.
There also was, you saw the rest of the field, with the exception of, I think, Elizabeth Warren, really coalesce and come out with an anti-Bernie message. You know, Pete Buttigieg cited one of the reasons he dropped out was he didn't want Bernie Sanders to be the candidate. So there were a lot of people very high up in the Democratic Party who really did not want him as the candidate, and they weren't afraid to express that.
And I think what that comes down to, rightly or wrongly, and frankly, that's still to be determined by history, I think, that a lot of the rubric of Sanders' campaign is easily targetable by right-wing messaging, which has spent the last several decades sharpening their claws on the idea of socialism and making it extremely toxic in the eye of the American voter.
I mean, was it that, or was it the people coming together saying that the right wing isn't going to like socialism rather than actually appealing to the Democratic base.
You mean concern trolling? That's what it is.
What is concern trolling?
Concern trolling is when you are expressing concern about something occurring when, in fact, you are using that as a negative argument against a given thing.
Yeah, I guess.
Yeah. Concern trolling is basically, oh, man, I'm just worried that those, right-wingers are just going to bury Sanders with this when, in fact, you're the one who opposes what Sanders is saying.
Yes.
Yeah.
I would say this, though. I think this has been no different than a lot of political races in that if you leave a void, somebody else will fill it.
That's right.
Bernie Sanders has been campaigning for a long time, and there is a big group of voters that he was not able to get, and apparently nobody really was able to get, that eventually went to Biden for whatever reason. And that's, you can blame some of this on maybe some establishment downward pressure. You can blame it on some other things, but at the end of the day, he left a void to be filled, and someone else did it.
Well, it's not over yet. And I mean, I will say that one of the several remaining moving parts in this race is the endorsement of Elizabeth Warren. And as a Warren supporter, I can tell you that I myself am watching very carefully to see who she ultimately throws her support behind.
And we'll see what happens in that Biden and Sanders are going to debate.
Oh, man.
And that could change some things, because it depends on which Biden you get. Which leads us into this this clip of Biden in Detroit campaigning, which I actually really like, but let's listen to it first.
How you intend on getting the union vote when there is a large portion of the union workers that are gun enthusiasts, and you are actively trying to diminish our Second Amendment right and take away our guns?
You're full of shit.
All right, thank you.
Now, shush. Shush. I support the Second Amendment. Second Amendment, just like right now, if you yell fire, that's not free speech.
But basically, Biden was campaigning in Detroit, and somebody came up to him and said, "You're going to take our guns away." And Biden said, "You're full of shit." And this is the Joe Biden I like.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. He can be very pugilistic when he needs to be, and he certainly knows how to argue.
And that's
a
straightforward, like, because his point was that I've defended the Second Amendment before, but I think there should be restrictions on things like assault rifles but I'm not taking your guns. And that's the kind of candidate that I think people want to see against Trump too.
No, that's right.
The question is, how much of that do we get versus how much of old man Biden do we get?
Well, in the South Carolina debate, Biden was very, very energetic. I honestly was a little bit put off by it, but he projected a lot of energy that I think voters really keyed in. It's like, okay, this guy's going to take the fight to Trump. And I think that he's riding that right now based on the idea that he's just going to be able to play that, you know, aggressive debate game and overmatch Trump, whereas, you know, Bernie might be more of an intellectual approach that wouldn't have the same impact.
I will say
on
it's
a television
clear,
audience. I'm not saying it's right. I'm just saying that this is how
it
a
is
lot
what
of voters
is.
Are going to perceive it.
Yeah. And it is clear that Trump is afraid of Biden to a degree that he's not afraid of Bernie Sanders for whatever reason.
Well, he thinks he can beat
Bernie
Sanders.
Well, there is evidence that Trump is very afraid of Bernie Sanders. What was it, back during impeachment a million years ago, there was the tapes from Lev Parnas that came out where Trump was talking about, you know, how he was actually very scared of Bernie.
Yeah.
And how he was keeping an eye on the socialism thing a lot.
Well, Bernie is obviously a very intelligent guy, and I believe that he would handily defeat Trump in a debate. It would just be a little bit different kind of a debate, that's all. And I actually think that in some ways Bernie would be a lot more appealing to educated voters who have really followed the issues than Biden would be in that debate. Biden is likely to throw a lot more blows and be a lot more acrimonious in pressing the attack on Trump. And obviously, that's what a lot of voters want to see.
Yeah, assuming debates have any real impact on the
turnout of
an election.
Well, that itself is a question. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
So let's talk a little bit about what's on everybody's mind, coronavirus. The day we're recording this podcast, Governor Jared Polis has issued a state of emergency in Colorado, which is not as scary as it sounds. It's more about being able to marshal resources if necessary.
No, that's right. And some of us would like for him to be able to marshal more resources, like, you know, toilet paper rationing or something, to make sure that it's more available on the shelves when I have to go get it, you know, late at night because my wife is out of toilet paper. But it's very sensible stuff. It allows them to cancel public gatherings, which was done right after the state of emergency was declared. The Denver St. Patrick's Day parade,
which is
canceled.
One of the bigger ones in the country.
Well, that's right. Was canceled due to concerns about the spread of coronavirus. And we've had a number of conventions now that have been canceled. A lot of people are canceling their travel. We just kind of got to hunker down and see here. I will say that Governor Polis is getting a lot of credit for being cool under fire here and handling this professionally, just kind of relating out the facts as the public health officials know them and calmly telling citizens what to do.
Here's a tweet from Kyle Clark of 9 News. I think Governor Polis is offering a masterclass on how to handle these situations. He is demonstrating a clear understanding of the science and is prioritizing the health and safety of Coloradans as he explains the steps being taken.
Yeah, cool.
I also want to commend Governor Polis. I know a few days ago he went out of his way to really show himself and be photographed at a Chinese restaurant when he was meeting with the Asian American community.
That's
the
right.
The meeting was pre-scheduled, but there has been a lot of irrational fear towards
now he just
the
needs
Asian
to drink
community.
A Corona beer. But not with this Chinese food. That probably wouldn't mesh. The way Polis has handled this is a quite stark contrast compared to the way King President Trump has been handling things.
It was a Politico story, wasn't it? A story in Politico about how Trump is not listening to his own experts who are asking him to please stay away from the handshake lines at public events. He's just sitting there glad-handing with all these people.
Well, his former chief of staff, Mick Mulvaney, who actually you may not even realize he'd fired him because it's only been a couple of days.
Well, no, he reappointed him out to pasture to some diplomatic post in Northern Ireland. I shit you not.
Yeah, that's what it was called. But he looked pretty sick when they were at the conservative CPAC conference. Mick Mulvaney did. There's a video of him going around just hacking into his hand.
Oh, man, that's wonderful.
Elbow cough, people.
Yeah, vampire cough.
Trump's new chief of staff, former Congressman Mark Meadows, is in quarantine.
I'm sorry. No, do not laugh. Okay?
Because
it's
he
not
was,
funny.
Because he was apparently exposed to somebody. And then on Monday, Trump flew back from Florida, where he was playing golf and raising money for his reelection campaign with Florida Representative Matt Gaetz. Is it Gaetz?
Gaetz.
Gaetz.
Gaetz, one of those, yeah.
Matt Gaetz is now in quarantine because of somebody he apparently talked to at the CPAC conference. So the odds of Donald Trump being pretty close to being infected are pretty good.
Much higher than the average person. I mean, if we're playing 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon coronavirus, he's awfully damn close.
The White House will not say if Trump has been tested, which I think is really weird.
If Donald Trump does get sick, he's going to have better care than a lot of ordinary Americans.
Well, and according to the White House press secretary, he is actually more stout than most of us because he doesn't sleep. Apparently,
like,
that
never sleeps.
I guess he's not sleeping lately.
Is that
he
how
works a lot.
Is that how his face becomes that like leathery orange?
I don't know. I
don't know what happens when you like never sleep. I heard it's
probably
bad,
not
though.
Good for your immune system.
Right.
That's not something
right.
that happens naturally.
Okay,
that doesn't
yeah.
occur in
the
nature.
Orange.
Right, right.
That hue.
That hue does not occur in nature. I believe that.
The political fallout from the way the federal government has handled or mishandled the coronavirus response is starting to really get to Trump and getting to his supporters too. This is Trish Regan on Fox News just going batshit crazy.
The chorus of hate being leveled at the president is nearing a crescendo as Democrats blame him and only him for a virus that originated halfway around the world. This is yet another attempt to impeach the president. And sadly, it seems they care very little for any of the destruction they are leaving in their wake. losses in the stock market. All this, unfortunately, just part of the political casualties for them.
So Democrats invented coronavirus?
Wow, no, not only that, apparently we persuaded Vladimir Putin to cut the price of oil, and there's like a whole bunch of things that seem to be left out of that analysis. Like, wow, that was stupid. Who was that?
Trish Regan.
Good Lord.
Reagan?
Okay.
Reagan?
Yeah, that was so monumentally stupid that it really, I kind of have no words.
But it does show you how worried they are, because
you don't go into
Looney Town territory like this unless you're really nervous about the political backlash.
Oh, that's right. I mean, what does it cost? Like $50,000 every 30 seconds to broadcast that insanity? I think that's low. That's like 1990s figures. Anyway, it's, yeah.
We've seen commentators talking about this being Trump's Katrina, this being Trump's Chernobyl, which they say is more apt because of how the government in the Soviet Union at the time did not really react to Chernobyl in time. But one way or the other, it's not going well for Trump. We talked last week about the fact that you can't pretend to not politicize this because you politicize everything. Everything.
Well, that's right.
Everything's related to politics somehow. And that they're going off the rails here, though, to the right and saying Democrats are now like essentially blaming them for coronavirus and
engineering the stock market crash. I mean, that's just really out there.
Yeah, that's lunacy. So speaking of the coronavirus, one of our Republican members of Congress who moonlights as the state Republican Party chairman or vice
double
versa.
Double duty, if you will.
Right. Ken Buck had himself a hell of a week last week. First, he was one of only two members in the entire House of Representatives.
One of only two, not two Republicans, not two Democrats. I mean,
two people.
The vote was 415 to two.
He voted against funding for coronavirus response. His rationale was some nonsense about how we have to watch our budgets and blah, blah, blah. But
who gives a crap what his rationale was?
Right.
I mean, 415 to 2. Well, all the other budget hawks were like, oh, okay, we better vote to, you know, for coronavirus.
Everyone else,
funding.
even as partisan as some of these Republicans can be, nobody else was dumb enough to fall on that sword.
Right. I mean, this is Ken Buck to a T. He does these things without regard to the political consequences because he doesn't think there are any political consequences for him in his ultra-safe district. It's horrifying, though. I mean, this makes Colorado look terrible.
Wasn't even the worst thing maybe that he did that week, though. At the end of the week, he sent out this tweet where he's standing in his office. He's got this red, white, and blue painted AR-15 assault rifle that's not operable, that he has called before like a paperweight or something.
Yeah. Well, the key part of the weapon called the bolt, which is what enables it to actually load and fire cartridges, was reportedly left back in Colorado when he brought it to D.C. for display.
Buck sends out this tweet, and I'll read it to you. I have just one message for Joe Biden and Beto O'Rourke. I don't know why he says Beto, but if you want to take everyone's AR-15s, why don't you swing by my office in Washington, D.C. and start with this one? Come and take it. Fuck you.
I mean, that's pretty hardcore.
What are you doing?
You know, he's making kind of an irresponsible threat. Of course.
You're a congressman.
Yeah. There's no way to, like, justify this or rationalize it. I mean, it's clearly inappropriate. And I mean, I guess the one thing you can say is that he has also referred to this AR-15 as a paperweight because the bolt's not in it. So maybe Biden and Beto should not be afraid of being shot by the representative of the 4th Congressional District of Colorado.
Congressman Eric Swalwell had a great follow-up tweet in response to Buck. He said, "No one is coming for your inoperable gun, Ken."
That's funny. no jokes, please. We all know what he meant, right? His inoperable gun.
It is true that until redistricting in 2022, Buck is probably safe in the 4th Congressional District. This is an area that's Greeley. Eastern Plains goes down south a little bit. It's a district that's drawn to be safe for Republicans, and it is, and he probably doesn't have to worry about his seat. But this is where we need something like none of the above on the ballot. So people can go and just at least do more of a protest vote. I think people know that you, I should say, I don't think people understand as much that you can undervote.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
You know, you can, you don't have to select everything, every race on your ballot. I don't know that people really realize that a lot. And if we had none of the above on the ballot, they have it in Nevada. You can't let it win, obviously, because then elections just go on forever.
Right.
But as a statement vote, and in Nevada, it has come out first a few times.
That's interesting.
But as a statement vote, then, you know, it would make somebody theoretically like Ken Buck pay
have
more attention.
To be at least minimally accountable to people.
Right.
Yeah. I honestly, that aspect of it, making it so even these guys in the safest of safe seats have to, you know, conform to like minimal standards of decency.
Not lose to none of the above.
Right, right. That kind of has merit. Now, one other angle with Ken Buck, of course, is the fact that he is also the chairman of the Colorado Republican Party. And there's a lot to suggest that management has not gone very well, and there's quite a bit of dissent within the party ranks, including some who've even talked about trying to oust him from that position. That probably wouldn't be very good for his congressional career in that event. We'd have to see.
Well, this is also shows, again, the problem of letting somebody even do this, being a congressman and trying to serve as party chair, because, you know, he can say his vote against the coronavirus response bill was in his role as a congressman, but it's still reflected as him as a party chair.
Absolutely.
Too.
It reflects on the whole party. I mean, there's no way that it doesn't. The party is supposed to be an accountability mechanism. I mean, it's one of its many jobs, is to be an accountability mechanism for the elected officials who claim it. And who's going to hold Ken Buck accountable for this? The party?
Right.
You know,
right.
Obviously.
I
not,
am the so. Party.
I am the party. That's right. So.
I mean, it's... is it just me, or does Buck almost seem to be getting, like, weirder as the months and years go on?
You know, there have been a number of points here where he, in congressional questioning, you know, his official duties, has been really unhelpful to Republicans. I mean, he said stuff that has just not helped their message, really killed the news cycle for Donald Trump a time or two back during the Russia inquiry, and again
when he asked Robert Mueller if Trump could be
like, oh, you mean
prosecuted.
You could prosecute him after? Really? So I just want to be clear that you could prosecute him after he leaves office.
Stop talking.
Every Republican is like, shut up. So, you know, there are certainly been some moments of what I would call unstrategic thinking on Buck's part. Whether or not that reflects some kind of broader degree of incompetence, well, I guess we'll have to see. For Democrats, having someone that incompetent in charge of the Colorado Republican Party can only be considered a good thing.
And for those of you in Congressional District 4, sorry.
I'm sorry, yeah.
That's all we can say. All right, now let's go and find our second favorite U.S. senator.
Finding Corey.
We actually don't know where he is right now. We know where he was yesterday.
Yeah.
On Monday, he was in Florida for a fundraiser. The third time, basically, he's been in Florida in like the last 10 days or so. A recent trip, though, to Palm Beach that showed up in Town and Country magazine. They have got to be pissed about this.
No kidding.
That his name showed up here.
Yeah. This is not the image that Cory Gardner is looking to convey to the voters.
From what we can tell, he was drinking $800, $900 champagne. It looks like on February 29th, Saturday, this story in Town and Country magazine. Here's the headline and the subhead. Inside the Palm Beach mansion that puts most VIP rooms to shame.
Wow.
A couple of billionaire art collectors hosted a decadent banquet and concert at their new palatial home.
Decadent.
And it was all for champagne. And Corey, it wasn't even a fundraiser for anything.
It was just to drink the champagne.
Yeah.
Out of the navel of models. Probably not. I'm making that part up.
Champagne party.
Wow.
Here's the part.
Sounds posh.
Here's the part that they got to be pissed about. Notable guests included Steve and Andrea Wynn, Pepe and Lourdes Fanjul, Republican Colorado Senator Cory Gardner.
Oh, my God.
And then a bunch of other people. It's just not good. And I'm not even sure how this all happened, because we looked back at the date and he was tweeting about being at a funeral in Colorado all day that Saturday. So somehow he got on the one flight from Denver to Palm Beach.
In time to keep up with the Kardashians or whatever
Fly to Palm Beach and literally drink $800 bottles of champagne with a bunch of rich people. I'm not sure what his connection here is, although I imagine it is billionaire art collectors Amy and John Phelan, who spend part of their year in Aspen.
Ah, okay.
So I imagine that's the connection with Gardner.
Huh. You know, this is how people get hooked up with the rich and famous. You become part of that, immediate orbit of the jet set where you're not yourself. I mean, Corey Gardner sells tractors. Let's be reasonable here.
Right.
But, you know, the parties of the really wealthy and powerful, which you get access to as a U.S. senator, that's got to be kind of fun.
There are pictures in this Town and Country magazine story
of him drinking champagne out of the navels of models.
No pictures of Corey, but God, if I had one wish, could a picture of him and being there show up?
God,
somewhere.
No kidding. Well, you know, I imagine they were pretty good at keeping the cameras out of that one.
Although they got his name got in there, and I'm sure that wasn't supposed to happen.
No, it seems like that probably was not meant to happen.
Oh, man. Speaking of Gardner, he was interviewed recently by the Colorado Sun, and as an article appeared in the unaffiliated newsletter, he used this excuse that he's used, I can't even tell you how many times. They asked him about whether he supports a proposed ballot initiative to ban abortion at 22 weeks.
Yeah, Proposition 120.
He said he hadn't read the initiative.
Yeah, how many times has he used this? he didn't read Obamacare. He didn't read the Obamacare repeal. Oh, wait, maybe he says he did read Obamacare.
He didn't read the impeachment.
No, the last
paperwork.
Bill he read was the Affordable Care Act in 2010, and since then,
he didn't read. He was asked about impeachment in November, and he said, "I haven't read the language."
Yeah,
that's his excuse for everything.
That's right, and obviously it's an excuse. He's not trying to convince anybody really at this. He's just trying to get out of the interview, get out of the conversation, say something to these guys so he can get into the elevator and shut the door.
I know not that what you talk about. I mean, dude, at some point, too, it's like, how do you not know?
Exactly. I mean, this is the stuff that everybody
who
watches
true,
the
if
evening
that's
news
true, how do you not know?
Right.
These are things you should theoretically be kept up on. All right, let's get through a couple of quick hits here. Justin Everett, somebody that is a name, Alan, I know you remember well.
Justin Sleepy Everett. The Sleepy Dwarf.
He was a member of the State House of Representatives for a couple of years from South Jefferson County.
Great guy. Great hair.
Oh, yeah? Great
oh,
hair.
Yeah. Nah. Hair. He's some kind of powerful styling product that really the wet look, well into the night. people are into that.
He was known primarily for falling asleep a lot.
That's
in
true. Yeah. Which is another thing. You want powerful styling products in your hair so you don't get deadhead.
That's a fair point.
I understand.
He is running again all of a sudden now for his old seat in the House District where there's a Republican primary. The interesting thing about this, though, is Everett left after three terms, I believe, in the State House. It's been 2 years since he's been gone. Now that he's running again, he hasn't accrued enough time away from the legislature to reset his term limits.
So his term limits are not reset. So he
can only run for one more term. So if he's successful and he wins, he's still got to go in 2 years.
So he couldn't sit it out for two more years.
I guess not.
That's weird. I mean, maybe he's worried about redistricting. Maybe he just needs a job.
I don't know. I mean, this really only happened in the last week or two that he just all of a sudden, right before the caucuses.
Yeah. Well, you recall he got temporarily benched from his committees and disciplined by the Republican House leadership for stuff like falling asleep, in the hearings.
not showing up
and stuff like that. I mean,
And then he ran for state
every
treasurer.
Every class has got one.
In 2018, he was a Republican candidate for state treasurer.
Ah.
Did not get out of that primary.
No, I'm
not even sure he made the ballot, or did he?
I don't remember him factoring in that primary much at all. We'll probably want to look that up.
It is interesting, though. The term limit thing is unique. I'm curious to hear why he's not waiting another 2 years.
No, some of these people just need the work. You know?
Well, you've got somebody like State Senator Vicky Marble, who is now running. She's termed out. So she's running for her old state House seat.
That's awesome.
You know,
the House pays the same as the Senate.
Right.
Neither, it doesn't pay anything.
Neither well.
Yeah, neither one pays well, but, you know, a job is a job.
One person we know who, well, at least at this point, who is also running for re-election in the state Senate, Republican Kevin Priola up in Adams County. In 2016, it was his race, Senate District 25, that probably saved Republicans the majority in the state Senate. They went on to lose that 2 years later. Priola is up for re-election this cycle, and his big stumbling block maybe Republicans.
Yeah, that's right. The blog that is believed to be operated by the Neville political clan put up a piece the other day that suggested there is a movement afoot by Republicans to recall Senator Kevin Priola, based on his supposed...
Because that worked really well with the Democrats.
Right. You know, they can't recall Democrats. They're just going to go for their own now or something like that. But no, Kevin Priola has this tendency to vote in a... Think and think critically, which occasionally leads him to vote in a bipartisan manner. He's a devout Catholic, so he was one of the key Republican votes for the repeal of the death penalty, which was just recently signed into law by Governor Polis. So,
according to this Colorado Citizen Press, Kevin Priola can't seem to get it together, and many in the Republican Party base are getting fed up with his liberal voting record.
Okay. If Republicans don't hold Priola's seat this year, they absolutely have no shot at
retaking. There is no path.
There's no path to retaking the Senate majority.
And if they don't have Priola as the general election candidate, they're not winning that seat.
No, that's right. He is, due to his moderation and his, you know, bipartisan credentials, easily the most competitive Republican they could field up there. This is another one of these suburban districts that is trending left, along with all the suburban county districts, Adams County, Arapahoe County, Jefferson County. These are all moving this way. And
but there's this faction of the Colorado Republican Party that says, well, we need to go further to the right.
In
order to turn left.
As we know, that faction of the Republican Party is principally responsible for the steady loss of Republican control and the smallest House minority in many decades here in Colorado. So if they want to keep going down that road, I think Democrats should
It is strange, though, isn't it? We talked just last week about this Liberty Caucus taking a crap on all the Republicans, basically, in the legislature, mm-hmm. save for a couple, and sort of threatening to try to get them challenges ahead of the caucuses. What are they doing?
They're trying to enforce ideological purity. And for these particular factions within the party, ideological purity is more important than winning.
For what? To have 10 losing votes instead of 8? I don't know.
It confounds political reason for all of us who possess it. And you kind of have to be an extremist. You're more concerned with party loyalty than actually succeeding with your agenda. I mean, this is the result. And their rump minority in the House is the result.
It's incredible. I mean, I can't understand that there aren't some people in the Republican Party who have enough pull who can say, what are we doing?
If there's anybody, any place where Republicans need to have some sense about them right now, it's in the state Senate, which is their, again, it's the biggest point of defense for Democrats. It's also the only opportunity that Republicans have to regain any
They're
kind
not
of
taking
influence.
The House majority.
Right. They're not taking back the House majority. If they were to get smart and not do things like cutting off their nose despite their face in the case of Kevin Priola, why, they might have a chance. But this doesn't look good for them.
No, not at all. Another thing that's looking less good the longer time goes on, remember that move of the Bureau of Land Management headquarters to Grand Junction? Cory Gardner, our second favorite U.S. senator, talks a lot about that on his as part of his re-election.
That there's only two.
Yeah, that's good.
All right.
Just for clarity, Colorado Sun, actually it was the Associated Press, reported recently that the BLM is not getting a lot of people moving to Colorado. Surprise, surprise.
Well, I mean, these are folks who are accustomed to living in D.C. They are professionals. They've got families, uprooting them all and moving them to a small Western Slope community with starkly limited services by comparison, none of the same civic or educational, entertainment, any kind of opportunities compared to what they enjoyed living there before. Why the hell would you want to move?
The Government Accountability Office says 81 BLM employees declined to relocate to Western states. Something like of 170 bureau staff who received relocation notices, 90 accepted, 81 declined. And there were about 130 positions already vacant when the relocation was formally announced. So people obviously had no intention of even going through this process. And this is what Cory Gardner is going to make one of his top three talking points in the fall.
These 81 people quitting their jobs and not moving to Grand Junction or other Western states, this is largely a strategy of the Trump administration to get rid of career bureaucrats.
That's right. Career professionals.
To get rid of professionals and to weaken the agency itself, the Bureau of Land Management, so that there's less oversight over cattle, over development of oil and gas, and digging things up, digging up mountains for
mining interests of all kinds. That's right.
Former White House Chief of Staff Mick Mulvaney actually said out loud last fall that part of why they were doing this and also moving some offices from the USDA to Kansas City was to cut down the federal workforce and the federal bureaucracy. I mean, they're not pretending otherwise. And the more information that comes out that shows that nobody else is pretending otherwise, I don't know how Gardner in November says, yeah, this is a thing you should vote for me for.
Well, as we know, Gardner is a master of saying one thing in D.C. and the exact opposite thing to the Colorado media. I mean, witness everything that he told local media versus national media about impeachment, just as one of many such examples. And look, the fact that these career professionals with the BLM don't want to relocate to Western states is not a knock on Western states where we all live and love to live. These are people's lives, though.
Right.
And to require this huge uprooting of their lives for political reasons, and certainly when they look at their careers beyond their position that they're in right now, they're going to do a lot better in Washington than they would be in Grand Junction seeking equivalent career opportunities. There's innumerable reasons why this would be a negative choice for a lot of BLM employees. It's a natural consequence of a misguided move.
Well, it did what they wanted it to do.
Right. It weakens the BLM. Bad for the bad for morale amongst BLM employees. Bad for the ability of the BLM to effectively do its job and conduct oversight over oil and gas and the other interests that are seeking influence there. The building in Grand Junction where the BLM is going to be headquartered is literally shared with oil and gas companies now. The list goes on and on.
Acting Director William Pendley will not move to
Grand
Junction either.
That would cramp his style, you know, and obviously what he expects for his employees is,
but I can see this coming up in a general election debate, say, and Gardner bringing this up and whoever the Democratic nominee is in this case, let's say John Hickenlooper, is really going to easily bat this down.
Oh, absolutely. Be able to blow it out of the water. And here again, John Hickenlooper was not unsupportive of the idea of the BLM moving out here, but the whole manner in which it's been conducted by the Trump administration, the obvious predatory nature of the way they're doing it and doing it, you know, without any regard to the career professionals that make up the BLM, there's just a world of difference between the way that a Democrat and Republican administration would approach this. And yeah, John Hickenlooper is going to slaughter him with this.
Absolutely. That's about all we got this week for the Get More Smarter podcast. The Get More Smarter podcast is a production of ColoradoPolls.com and Progress Now Colorado. Your hosts are Alan Franklin and me, Jason Bain. Ethan Black engineers and produces our show. The phenomenal Breakmaster Cylinder made our theme music. We record weekly in the basement of the Alliance Center in what is pretty sunny downtown Denver, Colorado.
It's nice today, I agree.
It is nice. Let's get outside.
Yeah.
And away from the coronavirus. Subscribe on Apple, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. Send us an email at angryrants@getmoresmarter.com. We'll talk at you next week.